Welcome to Ancient Future Faith with Dr. Chris Alford, pastor of Epiclesis, an ancient future faith community in Sacramento. Just what is ancient future Christian faith? Join Chris each week as he talks with special guests about a refreshing renewal in evangelical worship and spirituality that's helping many believers get in touch with their ancient Christian heritage. Now, with another look at how the road to the evangelical future runs through the ancient past, here's Dr. Chris Alford.
Well, that's me, and hi, folks, and welcome back to another conversation that has to do with ancient future faith. What in the world is ancient future faith, and what's an epiclesis anyway? Well, I want to encourage you to zip over to the Epiclesis website. As always, it's epiclesis.org. Learn more about our church and the wonderful way that God is using this band of believers in Northern California. On this program, we love to talk about a wide variety of things that intersect with and have to do with ancient future faith. And today, back for another in an installment, and what I hope will be at least another conversation, is my buddy Bill Cole, who is an author of several books, but more recently we're talking about Puritans and plagues and things like that. Hi, Bill. Welcome back.
Well, thank you, Chris. It's a pleasure to be back.
I don't know that I've told you, but I was just taking a look at the statistics of the folks who have listened to our previous podcast, which we want to highlight just a little bit. It's hundreds, Bill. And so I really appreciate you disseminating it amongst your genealogy pals. And but regardless, you don't have to be interested in the science or the techniques of genealogy to really appreciate this unique story, right?
That's correct. Yeah. What I uncovered in doing the research over an 8-year period is a whole series of stories that all intersect with our ancient future faith and frankly, has deepened mine along the way.
What we discovered, really, Bill, is that your family was at the center of Western civilization. Is that right?
Certainly.
No, but you know what? They were on the at least the sidelines and tangentially involved in some really important things. So we want to say, first, before we dive into today's topic, we want to encourage people to go back and listen to that. It's on the Epiclesis website, again, epiclesis.org. Just simply go to podcasts, and you'll search there for Bill Cole or Puritans, Plagues, and Promises, which is the name of Bill's book, which is available. I'm sure we'll talk about that several more times along the way. And listen to part one, because the story of, oh my gosh, your ancestors, their involvement in some pretty perilous politics of the time. Bill, just give us an overview of what we covered last time.
The Church of England was going through major transition, if you will, from its founding in 1538 by Henry VIII.
Right.
But Henry passes away in 1548, January.
You mean he didn't beat death?
No, he did not. In fact, there's an interesting story that even though he had founded the Church of England, his first request on his deathbed was to have the last rites administered by a Catholic priest.
I did not know that.
Oh, yeah. And yet the person he asked happened to be, I think, the Archbishop of Canterbury, who administered them himself.
Isn't that fascinating?
It is, because it's kind of believed that Henry actually was, quote, a closet Catholic. Mm. But he had left the church over the stuff with the Pope and not being granted a divorce,
right,
and therefore founded the Church of England and took away all their land and money.
So we get to your family, who are living north and west of London. He's a, for lack of a better word, an elder in the church.
Yes, yes.
And his pastor is involved in some pretty interesting intrigue.
Yeah, there are secret meetings going on because of new edicts issued by the now Archbishop of Canterbury, John Whitgift, starting in 1583. And we start the book with an episode where the pastor of the little church in Wedenbeck that my ancestor, Thomas Cole, is a church warden for.
And what does that mean, just briefly?
Well,
what?
Church warden is kind of like an elder of
the
church.
Okay.
Basically, same idea.
Yeah.
And Proud Love, in essence, borrows my ancestor's horse to go to this secret meeting.
So anyway,
he rides 5 miles, and there's about a dozen or so pastors that are all trying to discern together what these edicts mean, because they believe that it's varying from the word of God.
Right. And he gets even more involved in that and puts his own life and safety on the line at some point.
Yep.
Where did we get to in the last...
where we got to was, in essence, the vicar. Vicar is the same word for like a pastor, but it's an English term.
Which comes from vicarious.
Okay.
Really? Vicar, vicarious. Yeah. So the pastor is there as a vicarious representative of Christ himself.
Okay, got it. So the vicar of the little church in Wiedenbeck is arrested in May of 1590, and he is put on trial with eight other Puritans in front of the High Commission in London. He's thrown in prison. He's being asked to answer all of these interrogatories. The interrogatories from the church officials are, in essence, designed to trap them into confessions of violating the Common Book of Order. But it's a story that lasts over the course of 3 years of imprisonment. And my ancestor was in support, as was the entire town of Wiedenbeck, trying to get them released.
And the whole town backed their pastor, and they stood on what they believed to be godly biblical principles. And so they're major players in the whole Puritan movement.
Yeah, they made a stand and, in essence, removed themselves from their parish, which was not allowed in the Church of England.
And we have to just say that your own story is a similar one, in that when you and I first met each other, we were involved in helping a church of a mainline denomination to leave that denomination over what we felt were biblical godly principles.
And if I would have known this story then, man, would that have been a very interesting thing.
It's fascinating, isn't it?
It is. And that's one of the things I took away is, my goodness, Bill Cole is not the first of his ancestral line and descendant line to ever take on a major denominational church.
The Bill Cole Bill is talking about is my friend William E. Bill Cole. He's published numerous articles, and now this is his third book. He's a respected author. He's a wonderful speaker and business coach. He's a genealogical researcher. And he's an in-demand presenter for conferences and so on. Bill, you and your wife just came back from a bunch of genealogical and conference stuff. You want to just briefly tell us where you've been lately?
Well, yes. We just returned from a 30-day trip to the UK.
Lucky.
Yeah. I'm
so
I know
jealous.
You're jealous.
I'm so jealous.
But the first part of the trip was a full week in London. And one of the highlights in London was getting a chance to meet Graham Taylor, who is the author of the Mayflower in Britain book that was published in 2020. And Graham and his wife, Sheila, personally took Christy, me, and my English researcher, Nicola, on a one-day tour of all the Mayflower sites in London we could squeeze in one day.
Wow.
And he is a respected author. He is a tremendously acclaimed historian.
I was going to say, his book is kind of the gold standard on that issue, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And when he discovered my writing, we immediately started corresponding and set up this day. And I'll tell you, it exceeded all expectations. And if we ever get to talking about the Mayflower, I've got a lot more to say about that.
Well, that's why we're going to at least need one more of these conversations, because we're not even going to get to the journey to the new world today's conversation.
Yeah, not yet.
Folks, you're listening to A Conversation with Bill Cole. We're talking about his book and his research and his family. It's all down in a book called Puritans, Plagues, and Promises, Cole Clark and Collier in England to America. It's a big story. It is, I think it's movie-level stuff, Bill, honestly. I hope that somebody wants to pay you handsomely for a movie rights to this thing.
We'll see.
Where do we start today, Bill?
Well, since we've already talked about Puritans,
yeah,
let's transition to plagues.
Oh, that sounds juicy.
The second section of the book.
Right.
And so this is basically beginning in chapter 5. And interestingly, it ties into Proud Love being in prison. Because one of the things that happened in these trials before the High Commission and the Star Chamber is, in essence, the trials resulted in a draw.
There was restate that.
The end of the trials resulted in a draw.
With these Puritans being...
In other words, the Puritans weren't convicted of violating anything, but they also weren't released from prison.
And the conditions, we have to say, horrifying. And that was a part of your tour,
wasn't
it? That's
right, yeah. I visited, as you have done before, the Clink Prison,
right,
which is in Southwark, just on the south end of London Bridge. Mm-hmm. And it actually has torture exhibits and all that stuff. But what's interesting is I talked to the head of the Clink Prison exhibit at the end. Yeah, at the end of the tour, Nicola, my researcher, went and got him and said, you need to talk to her because we have things that you're not exhibiting. And so he, first of all, wrote down the title of the book. He said, I'm going to order it right now. But I then sent him a follow-up email and gave him the names of people he was missing that he could put up on a list on an exhibit of these Puritan prisoners who were in the Clink.
Was there anything about Puritan prisoners there on display? Anything
there,
at all?
There were, as a matter of fact, but none that listed the specific ones I knew about.
And the ones that you, sorry, I don't want to stay here too long, but it turns out the ones that you know about are especially important in terms of later civil rights, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, exactly. Several of them became very prominent in trying to progress the Puritan movement farther than Queen Elizabeth could take it when King James later took the throne, but we'll get to that later.
Yeah. I was thinking particularly of them not engaging in interviews and interrogatories that where they would incriminate themselves, which became important later.
Yeah, that's true. And current scholars actually point to these trials as foundational in the writing of the Fifth Amendment in the founding documents of America.
So, plagues. It's amazing to me that such a tiny little being, such a tiny little thing could have such devastation on a population, but also have, world-changing implications. Tell us a little bit about plagues and what is the plague?
Yeah.
How does this work?
Yeah, you know, the first recorded instance of the plague in London is in the 1390s. And by the late 1400s, 1493, the plague, in essence, was labeled also the Black Death.
Right.
The Black Death. Why the Black Death? Well, it's because part of the symptoms were that people's body parts would turn black as a result of the plague. Fingernails, toenails, just yucky stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But without grossing everybody out who's listening to this right now, let me just tell you a few of the symptoms and how they happened. You know, a lot of people believe that the plague was transmitted by rats, which is true. But recent scholarship also shows that they're also transmitted by human fleas and human body lice, for heaven's sake. Oh, it just makes my skin crawl.
I just shuddered.
But in the poorer areas of London, and Southwark is one of those areas, again, Southwark is the south end of London Bridge next to the Thames River. But in the poorer areas of Southwark, for example, because people were so close in their living conditions, and often there'd be 10 people or more in a single tenement, when a plague outbreak struck, it was then almost an edict from local officials that they would either lock the doors when a plague was discovered in a particular household, or they would even nail the doors shut. So if one family member, in fact, started with plague symptoms and it was found out, they'd keep the whole family there, and that often decimated entire family.
Even if you don't have rats with fleas on them, you might have lice or other body vermin of some kind that are carrying this, at least according to the research you said. And so quarantining is maybe exactly the worst possible thing you could do for this thing.
Well, exactly. For anyone without the plague, it was very highly likely that other family members would then contract it. So how this ties to my family is that I had an ancestral line I didn't even know about in my research. Yeah, not at all. I didn't even know the name. And it turns out my ninth great-grandmother was born in Suffolk in 1587, which is about the same time as when we started our story on the Puritans. And so my ancestor, her name is Jane Yates, was born in February of 1587. And that was a new genealogical find, one of the historic breakthroughs that I unveil in my book. But she was born to a father, Henry Yates, and his wife, Alice Yates. So those are my 10th great-grandparents.
Okay, help me just a second. I don't want to get the genealogy confused. Are they related to the Cole from Wedenbeck?
They are through her daughter.
Got it.
Okay. So anyway, that's the connection. But the family Yates is important because guess what? In 1592, there's an outbreak of the plague. The family at that point had 11 members in their household, including a servant. So a few smaller children had died, which was very normal at that point in time. In fact, statistics are about 20% of young children would die before they'd even reach the age of 10.
Good Lord.
And that had nothing to do with plagues. But when a plague outbreak struck, what happened to my family in 1592 is, first of all, Henry's daughter, Alice, dies. And she dies the same day he writes his own will. The father writes a will when one of the children die. Because several children had died up to that point, he must have realized he already had symptoms of the plague.
Oh, what a heartbreak.
Well, what a heartbreak. But, you know, when you think about what were some of the symptoms, oh my gosh. There were things called buboes that were like boils, and they would literally, particularly on the arms and legs, even groin area, would have these outbreaks. I mean, it must have been excruciating, and then pus and all that stuff.
Right.
So it's just this awful death, and when plague victims got the plague, they typically died in 2 to 4 days. 2 to 4 days, they'd be gone.
Gosh, in some ways, that's merciful.
Well, it is. Because you can imagine. So anyway, the result of that particular plague on my family is that the family was decimated. In fact, Alice, the wife of Henry, was already 7 months pregnant. And she is now widowed with two daughters who survived, Jane, my ancestor, and Margaret, and one son, Henry.
Wow.
And so what's a lady to do who's a widow, whose husband has a thriving business in the cloth trade? He was a dyer is what they called that at that point. I mean, she's desperate. She's got three young children.
Right.
She is pregnant. She has no real outside income. The business is now decimated. Very few women run a business without a man at that point in time.
Right.
And so another dyer in the same precinct in Suffolk is a man by the name of John Arnold, and his wife dies, Elizabeth, same time period, again in the plague. So guess what? 4 months later, Alice Yates marries John Arnold as her second husband.
Thank goodness.
Yeah, absolutely. What a lifesaver at that point in time. Now, just to be clear, Alice, the surviving mother of Jane, is also my ancestor. So there must have been something which people didn't know about, some kind of resistance to the disease, in essence, that she passed on to her daughter, Jane. Because Jane, as a young girl, survives this first plague.
Wow.
So now we have this family. There's a new family unit, and the new family thrives. John Arnold was in charge of a whole series of tenements in the Suffolk area. In fact, I have the exact location, and I stood on that street corner when I was in London.
Wow.
We now fast forward to 1603. So in a 10-year period, they didn't have any children. John must have been much older, as Alice was, and she'd already had like 10 children up to that point in time anyway. But it's now time for Jane, my ancestor, who's looking to get married. Well, she's looking to get married at a fairly young age, 16. But when you think about it, that wasn't that unusual at that point in time. So at the age of 16 years and 7 months, she marries a young dyer in the same area in Suffolk by the name of Thomas Clark. Now, Thomas Clark would have known her stepfather.
Right.
And because they were in the same trade, in the same area.
Might have even known of her father.
That's exactly right. Probably both in this case. So Thomas Clark becomes the husband of Jane Yates. So her now married name is Jane Clark. The subtitle of my book, Cole, Clark, and Collier in England to America.
Do me one quick thing, sure, just so I don't get lost. What is Jane's connection to the Cole that started the whole story, just to help me keep track of things?
Yeah, well, that comes into the fact that her husband in the next plague in 1610, Thomas Clark, dies.
Gosh.
And so she, again, is a survivor of a second, actually a third plague in 1610.
I was going to say, there's three that she's...
Yeah, exactly. She was a young five-year-old. Then she survives another plague in 1603. So anyway, now we have Jane, who has moved out of the 1603 plague to get married. They raise a family, and then 1610, another plague outbreak occurs, and it takes her husband and her youngest child, Henry, named after her father.
Let's stop there and say you're listening to a conversation with Bill Cole. It's a fascinating story about some ancestors who were very much involved in political intrigue, religious intrigue, faith, really, yeah. I guess you could boil it down to. It's a wonderful book called Puritans, Plagues, and Promises. It's available, we'll tell you how, in just a few moments. Bill, she finally, well, she survives three plagues.
Yeah.
Her husband dies, and her next husband is going to connect her to Cole, who started it all.
Right. She is now a widow with three children. Same issue. She needs to find a husband. So a man by the name of William Collier lived in the same parish, in the Suffolk parish, the south side of London Bridge. And somehow the two of them were connected, most likely through Jane's stepfather, John Arnold, because John Arnold later vouches as a surety in a document for William Collier. So she now marries in May of 1611 and brings three young children by the last name of Clark into the marriage.
Was her mother still alive at this point?
She was, yes.
That's pretty miraculous, too.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And John Arnold and Alice had a good life. They built a great business, and John did not die until 1620, and wow. Alice survived him. But now we have William Collier and Jane Clark married. There are three children already in the household who are now stepchildren to William Collier. And then they have their own family. They start having kids every year.
How many of them are there?
Oh, my goodness. The list is like 11 or 12 up to the early 1620s. And in fact, the interesting thing about William Collier is in approximately 1618 or 1619, he is doing so well as a grocer, that's his business. He is a thriving businessman. They already have a servant in their household and about 10 children by the time of an investor group, which forms because they know some people in Leiden, the Netherlands,
right,
who happened to be separatists from the northeastern part of England who left England on ships in 1607, 1608 to go worship on their own, not under the eyes of the Church of England, and the Netherlands was open to having them.
Wow.
So that happens to be the group that ultimately got on the Mayflower. So the investor group was formed before the Mayflower was even contracted as the ship, and they formed to found a new colony in America.
Wow.
And the connection is that Collier was one of the original investors and stayed with the Pilgrims the entire way through all their troubles and travails and the voyage and all of the early years of Plymouth Colony. So the Cole connection is William Collier and Jane Clark's youngest child, Ruth, married my ancestor, Cole. So that makes William Collier and Jane Clark my ninth great-grandparents.
So isn't that interesting then? Follow my thinking here because I might be messed up. But here's Collier involved in very similar kind of business as your ancestor Cole, but he never met him or knew him, and nor could he possibly know at that point that his daughter was going to marry one of the descendants of Cole.
No, he could not. But what was interesting is the Cole brothers from Wedenbeck, the first brother came to Suffolk to have an apprenticeship, and his apprenticeship was a grocer's apprenticeship, and his master was William Collier's apprentice.
So that's how the Coles get there.
Yeah, so this is a Zacchaeus Cole who arrives in Suffolk in 1621. His brother Job Cole leaves Wedenbeck.
Great Bible names,
yeah,
by the way.
Absolutely. Zacchaeus and Job. And so Job becomes William Collier's apprentice in 1626. Now that means that Job Cole is living in the same household as William Collier and his wife, Jane, and all of their daughters. And guess what? When they ultimately get to America, he marries one of the daughters. And so does my ancestor marry another one of the daughters. But that happens in America.
I can imagine that just those relationships and who lives and who dies and who's living with who and what are they, how are they, you know, keeping themselves alive, yeah. Children who live, children who die, investments. Oh, that must have been terribly complicated and time consuming to unravel.
Absolutely. And you know, you get all sorts of names and things confused. But let me tell you one little story. You already mentioned this, that Zacchaeus and Job were great biblical names.
Yeah.
Well, that's a sure sign of a family being Puritan, is that they actually were encouraged to use biblical names. And what was interesting, I had done all this research, and here I had found five Cole names: Zacchaeus, John, Job, Daniel, right down the line.
Habakkuk, Mephibosheth.
And I didn't even recognize they were all biblical names because I was so focused on the genealogy. But my researcher, Nicola, works in a group that has some nuns, and she asked them about these names, and that's the first thing they said. Sure. Well, these are all biblical names. And I go, oh my goodness, I missed that. So anyway.
How could you miss that one, Bill?
I'm sorry. It's the truth. Oh boy.
What fascinates me is this quest for worship and the abiding foundational faith that's moving in a variety of places and in a variety of hearts.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's almost as if the Holy Spirit is at work.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, one of the things, if we can go back to the 1603 plague as an example, that was when Queen Elizabeth had died, And King James from Scotland was appointed to be her successor. Well, King James was actually Elizabeth's cousin.
Right.
So when he then started his tour to come down from Scotland to London, he actually delayed coming into London because of the plague that was raging.
Right.
And then his coronation was delayed until it had subsided a bit. But the interesting thing is, when King James then was coming down to London, the Puritans in England had written what's called the Millenary Petition.
Okay.
What that means is 1,000 Puritans signed this document because they were so hopeful that King James would be open to their reforms that Queen Elizabeth wasn't.
So this was delivered to him?
Delivered to him while he was in transit coming to London.
Oh, they're trying to strike while the iron is hot.
Absolutely. And the result of that is the following year, 1604, after further delays because of the plague, King James calls for the Hampton Conference. Now, King James really didn't want to reform the church at all, really. And he was not open to the reforms presented in this petition. So he kind of set up the Puritans. There were only a couple of them allowed to even participate in the conference. Mm. But at the end of the conference in 1604, early 1605, John Robinson, who was the pastor for the Pilgrims, ultimately resigned his vicarship and joined a small congregation in a little town called Scrooby. Well, Scrooby is where some other of the founding Puritan pilgrims lived. And so a new congregation formed, and John Robinson wrote that the reason for his resignation is because he finally realized the Church of England would not be reformed.
Yeah.
So he made the decision to separate, and he led that little group from Scrooby to the Netherlands and later grew them 12 years later to become the Mayflower Pilgrims. Unfortunately, he didn't go with them on the original voyage. He intended to go later, but he died in the Netherlands and never saw America and his congregation again.
Wow, what a story. You're listening to a conversation with Bill Cole, and he is the author of several books, but the one we're talking about today is Puritans, Plagues, and Promises. It's a fascinating story about how the Puritans and the, gosh, it's that time of year, Bill, we're coming up to Thanksgiving soon.
Yeah.
The Puritans and the Pilgrims were working to have religious freedom and mm-hmm. to follow the edicts of Scripture and their own hearts, and your family was right in the very middle of it. Were there some other places where plagues had an effect upon your family?
The plagues did affect the Cole family dramatically. In fact, the 1630 plague took Zacchaeus Cole when he was in London, and he died. But also, there was another plague that happened just before that in Wedenbeck in 1626, and it took my ninth great-grandfather.
And are they still called Coles?
Yes, they were all Coles. So in all of the family groups, I lost ancestors.
Wow. Bill, when folks think of fires in London, they think of the big one in 1666, and mm-hmm. from the ashes of that emerge a number of things like better fire protection, hygiene, mm-hmm. that kind of stuff. And it effectively ended a big plague that was happening just prior to it. I think about the great St. Paul Cathedral that arises after that fire by the astounding architect Christopher Wren. But your family was also involved in a very significant fire that also had some devastating effects.
Yes, there was another fire well documented in 1633. It happened in February, actually, that my family was actually involved in putting out the fire that happened on London Bridge, and it devastated many merchant businesses. But what I'd like to say is that fires during this period and before were an ongoing issue in the crowded areas of London. It was not unusual for an entire neighborhood to burn down here, and then the ashes, out of the ashes, there'd be a rebirth and a new building. And that was a constant thing. One thing we don't often recognize about the Plymouth colony in America is one of their biggest exports was wooden planks back to London. That they made more of those to help rebuild London.
Right.
That was part of their business model in Plymouth Colony in America, was to supply London with wood.
Very wise.
Yeah.
So, Bill, in thinking about all of this, I'm going to ask you to do something that I did in the first segment as well. Let's talk big picture, sort of faith-sized mm-hmm. things. I know this has to have affected your own walk and your own faith. And when you are standing here in 2023 and looking back at this incredibly expansive and colorful story, what are the big takeaways? What are the big chunks? How does it hit your heart?
It hit my heart in multi-levels of ways. You know, obviously my family connection to these historic religious freedom
right.
issues. My family was in the middle of it. The fact that within churches even, we had different factions that almost persecuted other factions. And that's such a sad commentary on the Christian faith. And yet it's something we see even in today's world,
sure.
isn't it? So that knowledge certainly has affected me. But I think more so is a sense of admiration for those who've come before me. It's just amazing what they went through and the motivation they must have had in their faith, such a deep faith that they would trust God to provide without having an idea what was on the other side.
That's right.
In other words, God's promises, they trusted fully. And frankly, that's helped me trust in God myself more. If they went through all this,
right.
some of the things I face seem to pale yeah. into comparison.
You think about jail and
yeah.
inquisitions after a form, and you think about bubonic plague, and
yeah.
you think about investments being eradicated by fire. You think about traveling to unknown places. Wow. It does put things in perspective.
It kind of puts the perspective mm-hmm. of if your air conditioning system goes down, how does it compare to all they had to face
Absolutely.
Along the way?
Absolutely. Well, we're talking about a wonderful book called Puritans, Plagues, and Promises. It's by my buddy, William E. Bill Cole. Bill, where can people grab this book?
First of all, it's on Amazon in all formats, a hardcover, softcover, and Kindle version. Very easy to find. Just type in the title, Puritans, Plagues, and Promises. You can attach my name. Amazon is one good place.
Mm-hmm.
There are a limited number of hardcovers still available at the Pilgrim Hall Museum in Plymouth, and you can find them online and order from line. They'll ship directly to you wherever you are. They also have soft covers available. If you would like a soft cover autographed,
do we do that?
You would go to my website, passionategenealogist.org, and there's a contact Bill form on it, and just send me a note that you'd like to reserve a copy, and I'll respond to you and make the arrangements to get that book out to you.
Wonderful. Bill, any upcoming trips or conferences, or even virtual, I guess
I
should ask?
I have.
You do, don't you?
Yes, I do. On October 23rd, I'm doing a virtual conference to London on the plague. And so that'll be an interesting one. And we are the 10th of a series on sick London, particularly and how it affects genealogy, which is interesting because I would not have found my family at the depth I did
no.
without the plague deaths and the tracking that was offered in England at that time.
Isn't that an irony?
Now, the other thing you mentioned, though, Chris, is the upcoming Thanksgiving. And I am very excited about another webinar, which is on November 14th, sponsored by the General Society of Mayflower Descendants. It's worldwide for all 54 chapters,
wow.
including Australia, England, and all of North America.
Mm-hmm.
And that is going to be on William Collier, my ancestor, the investor in the Plymouth
right.
colony.
Well, forgive me, are you presenting in that one as well?
I am, yes.
Oh, okay.
And it's the Tuesday before Thanksgiving week, which is like prime time.
You know what I think? I think you ought to research contemporary garb of Puritans, and you should invest in an outfit.
Yes. Typically...
Honestly, I think you should.
Yeah, it would probably be a good idea. I will say that they do that in Plymouth today, Massachusetts, sure. Yeah. All the time. Right. They have parades and people dress up as their ancestors.
Yeah, yeah, and instead of Old West, old-timey photo, yeah. you make it with a yeah. Puritan or yeah. a...
But I'm really excited about that worldwide Mayflower yeah. one. That's yeah. a big deal.
Well, Bill, it's just always a pleasure to talk with you. We're going to at least have one more conversation because we've got to get your family over to this country. And I'm sure that the voyage over here and what they yep. do in the very beginning is incredibly important.
It so, is, yes.
Will you promise me you'll come back and we'll do another one?
Sure.
Folks, until we gather for another edition of Ancient Future Faith, I want you to remember that the road to our Christian future does run through our Christian past. We have lots to learn from those who came before us. And my thanks today to Bill Cole for telling us the stories of some pretty important ones who did. Until next time, the Lord be with you.